A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been living out of a box of protein bars since the move, and he's landed on something I think a lot of people discover by accident. Skipping a meal because the fridge is empty isn't just unpleasant. It's the thing that makes every other problem worse. Focus goes, mood goes, and for someone with ADHD, the executive function to fix the situation goes right along with it. So he started keeping a 24-pack on hand, and it worked. But then he noticed the gap. Protein bars aren't actually designed to replace a meal. They're designed to supplement protein, and there's a whole separate category of products that claim to be nutritionally complete. So he's asking four things. What's actually on the market? How do these differ from protein bars in their formulation? What kind of calorie delivery are we talking about? And for building a shelf-stable reserve, is it better value to buy shakes, buy bars, or make the stuff yourself in batches?
And the answer to that last question is going to be more interesting than most people expect, because the cheapest option per serving is also the one that fails exactly when you need it most. But before we get to cost, we need to untangle what a meal replacement actually is, because it's not just a marketing term. Well, in the US, it is. In Europe, it isn't. That's the first thing to get straight.
So today we're digging into the weird middle ground between a snack and a meal, and why the food industry has a legal definition for it in some places and not others.
Here's the functional definition. A meal replacement is engineered to substitute for a whole meal. That means balance macronutrients, protein, fat, carbohydrate, in proportions that would sustain you, plus a full micronutrient profile. 20 plus vitamins and minerals at meaningful levels. A protein bar does something much narrower. It delivers protein, usually 20 grams or so, with enough fat and carbohydrate to make it palatable. And it doesn't pretend to cover your vitamin C or your magnesium or your iodine.
So the difference is the difference between supplementing a diet and replacing a meal.
And that distinction is actually encoded in law, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on. In the European Union, there's a legal category called total diet replacement. It has a defined nutrient profile per 100 grams. If you want to sell a product as a total diet replacement, it has to hit those numbers. In the United States, meal replacement isn't a strictly regulated term. A company can put nutritionally complete on a label, and it's a marketing claim. The FDA has categories for medical foods, which are a different thing. But for consumer meal replacements, there's no legal definition forcing completeness.
So a European brand has to publish a full micronutrient panel because the law makes them. An American brand can be vaguer, and you're relying on their goodwill.
That's the regulatory asymmetry in one sentence. And it matters for label literacy. When you pick up a Huel bar, which is a UK company, you're seeing a panel that's been shaped by EU rules. When you pick up an American product, you're seeing whatever the company decided to show you.
And then there's the ADHD failure mode, which is what Daniel's actually describing. Low blood sugar degrades executive function. That's not a metaphor. The brain runs on glucose, and when it's running low, the prefrontal cortex, the part that does planning and impulse control and task initiation, it's the first thing to go offline. So you're hungry, and the thing you need to solve being hungry is the thing that stopped working.
That's the spiral. You can't shop because you can't plan. You can't plan because you're hungry. You're hungry because you can't shop. A shelf-stable fallback isn't a convenience in that scenario. It's a circuit breaker. You interrupt the loop before it tightens.
Which is why the format question matters more than people think. Because on the day when executive function is gone, the difference between opening a wrapper and measuring powder into a shaker is the difference between eating and not eating.
Let's get into what's actually on the shelf. The market for complete meal replacements has consolidated around a few names. Huel is the big one, especially in Europe and increasingly in the US. Soylent is the American counterpart. Then you've got Jimmy Joy, which is Dutch, Ample, Quill, and a long tail of smaller players. But Huel and Soylent dominate the mindshare.
And Huel in particular has pushed into the bar format in a way that's relevant to Daniel's question. Their bars run about 200 calories each. The powder is 400 calories per serving. Soylent's powder and ready-to-drink bottles are both 400 calories.
That calorie split is the first thing to understand about the category. Bars cluster at 200 to 250 calories. Powders cluster at 400 to 500. So the format choice encodes a calorie commitment. If you eat a Huel bar, you've eaten a large snack. If you drink a Huel shake, you've eaten a small meal.
Which means Daniel's protein bar habit and his meal replacement question are actually two different calorie strategies. A Quest bar is around 200 calories with 20 grams of protein. A Huel bar is also around 200 calories, but with 15 grams of protein and a whole lot more micronutrients.
Let's do the side-by-side label comparison, because this is where the formulation difference becomes concrete. A Quest bar, and I'm using Quest because it's the archetypal protein bar, delivers 20 grams of protein, about 1 gram of sugar, and roughly 10% of your daily value for most vitamins and minerals. It's a protein delivery vehicle. The micronutrients are incidental. A Huel bar delivers 15 grams of protein, more fat and carbohydrate to round out the macros, and 25% or more of your daily value for 20 plus vitamins and minerals. Same price point, roughly $2.50 to $3, but a completely different job.
So the protein bar is optimized for one macro. The meal replacement bar is trying to be a meal in miniature.
And the formulation mechanics behind that are worth understanding. Meal replacements use blended protein sources, soy, pea, rice, sometimes oat. The reason is amino acid completeness. No single plant protein has the full profile in the right ratios. Soy is close but low in methionine. Pea is low in methionine too. Rice is low in lysine. Blend them and you get a complete profile that rivals whey. Then on top of that, you fortify with the vitamin and mineral premix. That's the expensive part actually, the micronutrient blend.
The protein's cheap. The vitamins are where the margin goes.
And that's why a protein bar can hit 20 grams of protein for $2. But a meal replacement bar with a full micronutrient panel costs more for fewer grams of protein. You're not paying for the protein, you're paying for the fortification.
Now, the complete myth. I want to flag this before anyone gets too excited. Even a well-formulated meal replacement lacks the phytonutrient diversity and fiber complexity of whole foods. You're getting the vitamins and minerals, but you're not getting the polyphenols, the flavonoids, the hundreds of compounds in a vegetable that we don't even fully understand yet. And the fiber in these products is usually a single source, like oat fiber or chicory root inulin, not the diverse fiber matrix you'd get from eating actual plants.
That's the honest framing. These products are nutritionally adequate. They'll prevent deficiency. They won't optimize your biology. They're a fallback, not a lifestyle. Daniel said exactly this in his prompt. He's not advocating anyone live on these. He's describing a safety net.
And that's the right way to think about it. The question isn't whether a Huel bar is better than a salad. The question is whether it's better than skipping the meal entirely. And the answer to that's obviously yes.
Let me add one more layer to the regulatory story, because it explains something you'll notice if you shop across brands. European brands, Huel, Jimmy Joy, Quil, they publish full micronutrient panels. Every vitamin, every mineral, with percentages. American brands can be vaguer. Some are transparent, some aren't. The EU total diet replacement rules force a higher baseline of completeness, and that baseline becomes the market standard even for products sold outside the EU, because once a company builds the formulation for Europe, they sell the same thing everywhere.
So the EU regulation acts as a quality floor for the entire category, even in unregulated markets.
That's the knock-on effect. Regulation in one jurisdiction raises the bar globally, because reformulating for each market is more expensive than just meeting the highest standard everywhere.
Which brings us to Daniel's real question, the value for money question. And this is where it gets interesting. Well powder lands at about $1.50 to $2 per 400 calorie serving. Soylent powder is comparable. Huel bars run $2.50 to $3 each. And remember, that's for 200 calories. So per calorie, the bar is roughly double the cost of the powder.
The DIY option is where the math gets seductive. You can build a bulk shake from oats, protein powder, nut butter, maybe some milk powder, and a micronutrient premix, and get the cost down to 50 cents to a dollar per serving. That's a third to a half of the commercial powder price. And if you're making it fresh each time, it's fine.
But here's the catch. The shelf life. Commercial powders hold 12 to 18 months unopened. Commercial bars around 12 months. A DIY premix shake lasts 1 to 2 weeks in the fridge. If you're batch prepping a week of shakes on Sunday, that's fine. If you're building an emergency reserve for the day when everything's gone wrong, the DIY option evaporates exactly when you need it.
That's the trade-off Daniel's question is really about. He said shelf-stable reserve. And shelf-stable is the operative word. The DIY cost advantage only exists if you're consuming on a regular schedule and can manage the prep. For a reserve that sits in a cupboard for months until the bad day arrives, DIY doesn't work. You'd open the fridge and find a science experiment.
So the practical answer is a hybrid. Stock a box of bars for the can't function moments. Stock a bag of powder for the can manage 2 minutes of prep moments. Different severity levels of the same failure pattern require different tools.
That maps directly onto the ADHD experience Daniel described. On a bad day, opening a bar requires one motor step. Tear the wrapper. That's it. Measuring powder requires water, a shaker, scooping, shaking, and then washing the shaker later. That's not two steps. That's five or six. And when executive function is gone, five steps might as well be 50.
The bar is the break glass option. The powder is the I can function a little option. And the DIY batch is the I'm having a good week option. You don't have to choose one. You can have all three at different points on the spectrum.
There's a micronutrient risk with DIY that's worth naming too. Hitting macro targets with oats and protein powder and nut butter is easy. Hitting all your RDAs is not. You need a micronutrient premix, and sourcing a good one is its own project. Commercial products are tested and consistent. Every batch of Well has the same vitamin profile. Your kitchen blend is guesswork unless you invest in the premix and measure carefully.
The DIY savings are real, but they come with hidden costs. The upfront sourcing effort, the mixing time, the shelf life problem, and the micronutrient uncertainty. For a reserve, that's a lot of downside to save a dollar a serving.
Let me put a number on the comparison for Daniel's specific use case. He wants a shelf-stable reserve. Say he buys a box of 12 Huel bars at about $3 each. That's $36 for 12 can't-function meals. A bag of Huel powder at about $180 per serving, a 17-serving bag is around $30. That 17 can manage 2 minutes meals. For $66, he's got a month of fallback coverage at two different severity levels.
Compare that to DIY. He could spend $40 on ingredients and get 40 servings, but they'd need to be made fresh, and on the bad day, he wouldn't make them. The commercial option costs more per serving, but it's there when the bad day arrives. That's what he's actually paying for.
There's a second-order observation here that I think is the most interesting part of this whole category. Engineered complete foods challenge the real versus processed binary. We've been trained to think processed equals bad, whole equals good. But these products are heavily processed and nutritionally complete. They're not junk food. They're not health food either. They're something new. They're the food equivalent of a life raft. Not a place to live, but very good at what they're for.
The processed food framework assumes processing removes nutrition. These products use processing to add nutrition back in. It's the same technology, pointed in the opposite direction.
That forces a redefinition of what eating a meal means. Is a meal defined by nutrient delivery or by the experience of eating? Because a Huel shake delivers the nutrients of a meal in 90 seconds with no chewing, no cooking, no social context. If nutrient delivery is the whole story, then it's a meal. If the experience matters, then it's something else.
I think for Daniel's use case, the answer is that it doesn't matter. The question isn't, is this a real meal? The question is, does it stop the spiral? And it does.
We tried to make the consumer version in 97. I was doing quality control for a company that made hospital meal replacement shakes. The Ensure class of products. Regulated as medical foods by the FDA. Every batch had to hit the nutrient profile or it didn't ship. The problem was the taste. Full vitamin and mineral load tastes metallic, like licking a penny. We tried to make a pleasure version for the consumer market, but the only way to mask the off flavors was sugar. We added so much sugar that the nutritional profile was shot. The product failed. Whole line got canceled after 18 months.
The taste problem was the binding constraint.
It wasn't a problem we could solve with the sweeteners available then. Aspartame had its own aftertaste. Sucralose wasn't approved for that use yet. So, it was sugar or metal. We chose sugar and lost the medical food claim.
That explains something about why the modern products took so long to arrive. It wasn't the nutrition science, it was the flavor chemistry.
The modern stuff, Hoyle and Soylent, they don't try to taste good. That's the trick. They market themselves as fuel. The expectation is different. If you tell someone this is a delicious shake, they're disappointed. If you tell them this is what you drink when you don't have time to eat, the blandness is a feature. They reset the expectation, and the taste problem went away.
The innovation wasn't better flavoring. It was worse promises.
The packaging was the other thing. Our product had a 24-month shelf life, and it wasn't preservatives. It was the oxygen barrier packaging. Specialized laminate. Expensive. The question I'd ask about today's bars and powders is whether they're investing in that same quality control or cutting corners on the packaging to hit a price point.
That's a good question. The shelf life claims on modern products are shorter than what you're describing. 12 to 18 months, not 24. So either the packaging is worse or the claims are more conservative.
Could be both. The laminate we use cost about 40 cents a unit in 97 money. That's probably a dollar now. If you're selling a bar for $3, a dollar of packaging eats your margin. So you use something cheaper and the shelf life drops.
Which means the reserve strategy has a maintenance cost. You can't just buy a box and forget it for 2 years. You have to rotate stock.
Everything rotates. That's the rule. If it sits, it dies. We used to put date codes on everything and pull the old stock for the hospital discount channel. The stuff still tested fine, but the lawyers wouldn't. Let's sell it at full price.
The practical advice is to treat a meal replacement reserve like any other emergency supply. Check the dates, rotate through it, replace what you use.
The clause made the packaging inspection tricky. The laminate was slippery. I dropped more units than I tested.
I imagine the snout didn't help with the taste panel either.
I wasn't on the taste panel. I was in the lab. The taste panel was marketing people. They all had opinions, and none of them had to drink the metallic batch.
The metallic note comes from the minerals, iron, zinc, magnesium. They all have off flavors at high concentration. The modern products use encapsulated minerals, which is a coating that prevents them from interacting with your taste buds until they're in your stomach.
Encapsulation was experimental when I was doing it. The coating would break down in the retort process and you'd get the metal taste back. They probably solved that by now.
They have. The modern bars are palatable. Not delicious, but not metallic. The technology caught up to the ambition.
I still wouldn't want to live on them. But for the days when you can't function, they're better than nothing. That's what we used to say about the hospital product. It's not food. It's what you eat when you can't eat food.
That might be the best definition of the category I've heard.
The open question that leaves me with is whether the psychological satisfaction of eating a meal can ever be engineered, because these products solve the nutrient problem completely. But they don't solve the feeling of having eaten. And for some people, that feeling is the point.
There's some work on this. Chewing matters. The mechanical act of mastication sends satiety signals that drinking doesn't. A bar is better than a shake on that axis because you chew it. But neither one replicates the sensory experience of a meal. The texture variety, the temperature, the social context.
Even a nutritionally complete bar is leaving something on the table. The question is whether that something matters for the fallback use case. And I think for the fallback, it doesn't. The fallback is about preventing the spiral, not about satisfaction.
The future of the category is probably personalized meal replacements, tailored to gut microbiome profiles or genetic markers. The technology for that's getting cheaper. We're already seeing companies do basic personalization, like adjusting the macro split based on your activity level. The next step is micronutrient personalization based on blood work.
That would turn the category from a fallback into something more like precision medicine. But it also raises the price, which pushes against the emergency reserve use case.
For now, the practical takeaway for Daniel is the hybrid. Bars for the worst days, powder for the moderate days, and the understanding that neither one is meant to replace real food forever. It's a safety net, not a lifestyle.
The best option is the one you'll actually use at your lowest. That's the real test. Not the label, not the cost per serving, not the micronutrient panel. The thing you can still manage to eat when eating feels impossible.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumentop for producing, and for the packaging insight, which I'm going to be thinking about every time I check a date code now.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own weird question, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.